If I can just have your attention, Jim Spates is prepared and ready to go, so we can just ask everyone to have a seat again. We'll let him start. And this time I'll remember to introduce Jim, since I forgot to introduce Tim. Sorry about that, Tim. And if you have your program, you'll see that Jim is speaking on the seven lamps of architecture, and the title of his talk is All of Us Are Builders.
Thanks, Sarah. You know, I don't know whether everybody's got one, but there is a handout that goes with this talk. I don't really intend it so much for the talk, although I intend it for reference later, but I'll be referring to all of these seven lamps of architecture as we go along. So if you don't have one, you can pick one up later or now, as the case may be. So, all of us are builders. It's a great pleasure to be back. We had a lovely gathering last year, as many of you know who are here. I gave a talk on trying to summarize the essential ideas of Ruskin's wonderful small book called Unto This Last, his scathing attack on laissez-faire capitalism. A much underread book. But it's possible to get one because Clive Wilmer, who's right here, is the editor of the Penguin Edition. He's handing out various pamphlets, is here, and his book is on the back table. You can take home and read Unto This Last tonight if you choose. And we hope that you will do that. Anyway, it's one of Ruskin's great masterpieces, and what I want to talk about today is what I believe is another of Ruskin's great masterpieces. Again, very much ignored, forgotten, The Seven Lamps of Architecture. And it's a wonderful book. It was published in 1847. Ruskin, in fact, I think what I'm going to do is I'll move it along a slide or two here and see what goes on. This is Ruskin's home in Brantwood, where he moved in 1870. He bought the house up in the Lake District of England. And this is his own watercolor of his home. And it's a beautiful watercolor, and as you can see, and it sits up among those lovely hills, the fells of the Lake District, and so on. He made one serious architectural change to the house itself. Otherwise, didn't do very much to it at all. He put in a window in the front, looking essentially south, with seven panels to it to symbolize the seven lamps of architecture that he had written about. The story of the seven lamps of architecture is more or less, I'll give you a broad little vision of Ruskin as he began the seven lamps of architecture. I'll tell you just a spot about why I got so interested in it, and then I want to go through the lamps with you. Ruskin was very famous pretty young in life by writing two wonderful books called Modern Painters I and Modern Painters II, where he championed the artwork of Turner and championed the artwork of the great Renaissance or pre-Renaissance masters, as Tim pointed out a little bit earlier in his talk, his great talk. I thought it was wonderful. As he gathered all the material for this, Ruskin went through Europe a number of times, sometimes with his parents, sometimes by himself, and then going through Europe, he began to look at the communities in which all of this art was produced, which got him also looking much more seriously at the whole phenomenon of architecture itself, which produced, in the end, this wonderful book, The Seven Lamps of Architecture, which we're going to talk about today. Tim gave you a number of Ruskin quotes. I'm going to give you a few as I go along as well. But this is one of my favorites. It's very short, but it's very, very, very profound, I think. This is a self-portrait of Ruskin about a little bit after the time The Seven Lamps was written. But the lines read as follows, if you cannot see them. You cannot find a lie. You must make it for yourself. False things may be imagined and false things composed, but only truth can be invented. And the seven lamps of architecture is, in my view, about the invention of truth. He found a truth that was always there, which we had forgotten. He wrote it down. He wanted us to know about it. He wanted us to remember, and as I'll say at the end, he wanted us to remember the things we already knew, so we could then put them into life, into our own lives. The seven lamps of architecture. I, am a sociologist. That's how I got interested in Unto This Last and other writings of John Ruskin about the social world. But I'm also an urban sociologist. So one of the things that I do in my teaching life is that I take my students to cities and look at architecture with them. And that's one of the things when I started getting very interested in Ruskin, which was about 20 years ago, maybe a little more than 20 years ago, I began looking at architecture myself. And I thought, well, I really must read this wonderful book, The Seven Lamps of Architecture. And so I've done so a number of times and taught from it. And it is one of the great neglected masterpieces, not only of the Ruskin canon, but I believe of the artistic and architectural canon. The book is almost completely forgotten now, hardly read by anybody. Later in life, Ruskin came to think that it was not one of his best books. I don't necessarily agree with that, but that's all right. He certainly had his view on this. But the tragedy, I hope I give you a sense by the time we're done today of the tragedy of not knowing about the seven lamps. And here they are. They are sacrifice. We're going to work through each of them. I'm going to show you a whole bunch of, I hope, useful slides for you to think about this as we go along. They are sacrifice, truth, power, beauty, life, memory, and obedience. And when all those seven lamps are present in a building, then the building soars and is gorgeous, and we love it, and we react intuitively to all of those lamps lit in their various ways in the building. And when they are not there, one lamp not there, two lamps not there, three lamps not there, whatever the case may be, our own experience of the building is dulled. We are dulled. Architecture, Tim's wonderful comments about joining. Joining architecture is one of the ways we join ourselves to the world. All of us are builders. We have our homes, we have our offices, we have our second homes or whatever we have in our lives. Those are our expressions of our life in building. And Ruskin wanted to remind us of these things. The handout is there. I want to start with the first two. I'm just going to read the first two quotes with you because I like them very much to frame what we're going to do, and then we'll get into the lamps themselves. The first one, very brief, comes from a novel by John Sanford called Buried Prey, and he writes as follows. Lucas had gone in and out of Minneapolis City Hall probably 10,000 times during his career and always marveled at how the original architects had managed to contrive a building that was at once ugly, inefficient, cold, sterile, charmless, and purple. And yet they had. The second one is Mr. Ruskin himself, and he writes, architecture is that art which so disposes and adorns the edifices raised by human beings for whatsoever uses that the sight of them contributes to his or our mental health, power, and pleasure. Moreover, architecture is the one form of art in which everyone participates, if only because we all need homes and buildings. It's a lovely, lovely line, and I take it as my theme for what we're going to do now. So here we go, seven lamps of architecture. The first one, the lamp of sacrifice. I want to say that his arrangement in the book is into seven large chapters, of course. It was a brief introduction, a brief epilogue. The organization is heuristic. In other words, he wants to give us a model so we can talk about these one after the other. But sacrifice doesn't precede truth, and truth doesn't precede beauty. They all kind of mingle in a building at the same time. But he separates them out so we can have a serious chat about them. So here is, make sure I got my things that I want to share with you here. Here's a brief summary of the lamp of sacrifice and what it means from Ruskin's work in the Seven Lamps. He writes, but I paraphrase, all buildings, that includes homes, hotels, offices, bridges, and many more things, come into being to perform a function, to be a church, a government office, a house. To sacrifice in the creation of any building is to add something not truly necessary for the performance of that prime function, something which causes the sacrifice of the creator's imagination, time, materials, money, or effort, something which, as it is added, makes the one sacrificing feel that they are doing their job as it is defined, properly, at the highest level of which they are capable. So you hear echoes in this of Tim's wonderful talk and being a joiner, right? that they are engaged in creating something in which they can feel pride, something which points to their integrity as builders, or I should say probably as participants in the building process, because there's many people involved in a building. And when any given sacrifice is finished, it allows the beholder or user to enjoy the building more. It puts something into the building that creates a life force in it that wasn't there if it were merely a utilitarian object. It's really a central notion. And that moreness, that livingness, is what pleases our emotions, that fires our imagination, that makes us excited, that makes us inspired, that makes us sometimes in nothing other than awe. That's sacrifice. It's doing more than what is needed to make the building do what it essentially has to do. So, again, I'll pick up Tim for a moment. You know, the frame that makes the painting live, as opposed to, sorry, Tim, I just had to get it across the country simply, a frame that you buy in a 5 and 10 cent store, I guess they're $20 and $30 stores now, where you just put it around it. But the kind of things that Tim does that makes the painting and the frame one and come together, that's what he means by sacrifice. It's more than is necessary, and it gives it everything. So sacrifice. First lamp. Well, not really, but you understand the point. I'm going to take you far away first. I'm going to take you to France, to the north, a little bit to the northeast of Amiens, a little bit to the northwest of Amiens, the great cathedral city of France. This is Ruskin's drawing of the town square in Abbeville, a small city in that portion of France, done about 1842, 1844, somewhere in that area there when he was visiting with his parents. Is that clear? Well, it's about as clear as I guess it's going to be. But I wanted you to have a look at that. That's an old French medieval, and at one point even American kind of old town. I want you to look at the buildings here. I want you to look at the roofs and the differences and all of the buildings. It's so interesting to look at the buildings because they're all the same. They all have a pattern. And at the same time, they're all different. And so they have these two qualities going along at the same time. This is one person. This is the butcher's house and the butcher's shop. And this is the carpenter's house and the carpenter's shop. And this is the grocer's house and the grocer's shop. And they're the same, but they're the different. And there's a vibrancy there. If you look along the town square and see all these buildings, this is a magnificent drawing. It's at the Ashmolean in Oxford. And if you notice in the background, there's a wonderful small church. It's not really a cathedral. It's sort of a super county parish kind of church called St. Wulfran's. And St. Wulfran's, this is just one of the doors in the front, in the west-facing front of the church. There are three main doors. This is the one on the right. As you look, and I want you to look, if you would, at all the details of this. And I see this is exactly what he means by sacrifice. You needed a door, you needed a place for people to go through, you needed to create an arch, you needed to create a wooden door for people, but look what else they have done. They have taken, and they've done what Tim does with frames, they have taken their own crafts, their own stoneworking crafts, and they have made this into a thing of enormous beauty. Look at this wonderful work here. The work going up to this triangle point here. And then not being done with that, they have it all here as well. And then not being done with that, they have it here as well. And then they have it all around the arches here. And then the central figure here. None of this is necessary for the door. It's very necessary to make the building live. And it does. And when you go to see it, which I have done in not too distant past, there's an entryway to St. Wulfran's. There's the main door. This is the one we're talking about a moment ago. It still stands. Yeah. And now we'll go to the next slide, which is the door that we were just looking at. Sorry, this is the one on the other side here. And they've done the same thing on the up above the other door. They've taken all the creative spirit they have, the energy, the thought, the imagination. And the people who are carving the stone are involved, and the people who are wondering what the door should look like, and whether it should be Moses, or whether it should be St. Matthew, or whether it should be whomever above the door, have all kind of worked together to create this wonderful door. That's one door. I showed you the other one a moment ago. Here's a close-up of this part of this door. is just so wonderful. The figure almost floats in the air. There's lambs, there's sheep, there's all of these figures to the side. There's saints over here. This is living architecture sacrifice. They did it because they wanted to do it. They did it because they got great joy out of doing it. They did it because they believed in these ideals of the church. Yeah? Above the central door, this is the rose window area. Ruskin calls these times, I'll give you a quote from him in a moment, he calls these great times of building in Europe, he calls them the great times, the time when everybody in the community, this is a community effort, and again I'm thinking of Tim's wonderful comments, this is a community effort, everybody's involved in the building of the church. This is not the architect says, everybody does this in exactly this way, and you do whatever I want, however I want, in the way that I want. This is people saying, all right, I'm going to do the, I have to do the snake, or I have to do Adam, and I have to do Eve, or whatever I have to do, but I'm going to carve it in this way, and I'm going to put myself into it, and that makes Adam come alive, and that makes Eve come alive, and makes the snake come alive as well. They're not rote activities that are going on in a church like this. This is a side, this is the north side of the church. They could have left it blank. They said, no, we don't want to leave it blank. This, after all, is the church. Let's put in these wonderful sort of floral plant-like motifs on the side, wonderful high Gothic carvings. Inside the church, this is one of the central windows. It's not just a window. It's a carved window telling all the stories of the Bible that they wanted all the people who came to the church to know and to understand. So outside the church is exciting. Wondrous. Inside the church is exciting and wondrous. And when we walk in, we get those qualities ourselves. This is another Ruskin drawing of a very small niche. Four of them around each pillar in the Cathedral of Lyon. And I have a nice description of where he talks about this, if I can find it. Maybe I can't. That would be too bad, because it's really lovely. Give me a moment. Well, I can't find it, but I'm going to tell you about it. So the quote says, in effect, he says, I want you to look at this. This is about 12 inches high on one column, of which there are 30 columns, in the cathedral, like this, four sides, each column, and look at what they have taken the time to do. He says there's a rose plant that has been carved around the figure of a bishop, probably a bishop of some note in the Cathedral of Lyon. The trellis, the pointing branch of the rose is pointing to the head of this lovely young woman, and all of this beautiful thing, and she even has a, you can't quite see it here, I don't think very well, but she has a little bit of hair that's come loose. They didn't have to do that, but it gives her life. It makes her into a real person in a wonderful way. Sacrifice. Yeah? To make the world beautiful just for the sake of wanting to make the world beautiful. Another Ruskin drawing of St. Wulfran in Abbeville, we're back there again. And what I want you to note is not only the back of the church right now, but I want you to note these buildings here, because they're very like, they're just, this is about a block away from the main town square that I showed you an example of before. But here's a nice image of them, showing them as all of these different individual buildings, still same style, but still quite different from one another, and quite vibrant, as you can see. Much of that is gone. In fact, almost all of it is gone because something happened to Abbeville in the middle of the 1940s, and that was called bombing, and much of the town was destroyed. I'll come back to that in a moment. So most of those are gone, but Rouen, there's still much of wonderful things going on in Rouen. This is one of the main shopping streets of Rouen. Here's a close-up of the clock tower. I want you to have it just look at this wonderful building here. Look at the clock tower itself, different in style. Different people made it at different times. Here's one of the streets of Rouen. This is a city that dances. Yeah? It's a city that around every corner you get a new vista of a different piece of architecture. It's not the same. Here's another one. another side street in Rouen. And again, all of these buildings are down the street, but here's a sort of old Tudor, and coming up, here's some more Tudors, and so, but they're all different. They all have their own vibrant living quality. Here's a side street. Yeah, with the wonderful geranium pots on the outside, livening up, etc. Ruskin's argument. Sometimes people say, oh, well, you know, they did all that stuff because that's Gothic cathedrals. Ruskin's argument is fundamentally different. He says, no. Before the cathedrals were Gothic, the houses were Gothic. The cathedrals are but the manifestation in large by the people of the town or the city or itself. They've just taken what they were doing in their courtyards anyway and made it larger. So, this is Ruskin's picture, commissioned by him while he was there, of a courtyard in Abbeville. And again, you see here, they've taken the time to do all of these things, to build little arches. That's probably a support arch at the same time, but different kind. Just to show you that his whole argument, again, I think of Tim's talk, and I think about this whole argument about the importance of each individual person being involved in the process. So here's Abbeville Town Square again, 1845. And here is exactly, or almost exactly, the same view today. And look what's happened. Well, the war happened, a terrible thing. They had to rebuild after the war. But look what they forgot. And so these buildings that are now there in the Abbeville Square, and here's, again, a comparison for you. That's the way they were here. This is the same view, slightly closer today. So they forgot about sacrifice. Maybe I don't know whether they had ever thought about it too much. I think they probably just built these buildings and then decided to build this church and so on. But what happens here is that when they're rebuilding, they don't remember. And so what you have in its stead, going back one, is not this, a place full of vibrancy and difference and excitement, but this. These are apartments, and they look like apartments almost anywhere in the modern Western world. Tim's comment, or another Tim comment about separation. Sacrifice. When we take the time to sacrifice, buildings come alive. We don't take the time to sacrifice, they die. But it's much worse than that. We die because we use the buildings. We walk into the buildings. We're in the courtyards. And in those other courtyards, 1845 when Ruskin did his drawing, well, there's all the people we know, and there's the butcher and the baker, and there's the plants, and there's the water, and the kids are playing, and there's all the stories. Somebody's ill, and you go for this shop to that shop to that shop. Now we go to supermarkets. We lose truth. Second lamp. Here's a summary for you. All buildings, Ruskin said, should be constructed with natural materials, wood, stone, marble, brick, or the like, because they are natural materials, because only natural materials feel right to the eye and soothe us when we come into contact with them. The eye immediately recognizes anything false, anything synthetic, like linoleum floors, or anything that pretends to be something else, like houses with veneered walls that are made to look like wood but aren't wood. You know immediately, your eye knows immediately that this is not the real thing. And intuitively, we don't like how these false things feel. If we put it another way, it's as though when we encounter bogus materials in a building, we feel a bit cheated, we feel a bit disrespected by the architects as though they didn't care anything about us, which is probably right. They probably didn't. Even if we have those reactions subconsciously, which we frequently do. But when materials are natural, we immediately feel comfortable and at home, and none of the just mentioned negative reactions occur. In other words, in architecture, as in life, deception always harms. And that the materials used, the natural materials used, should be of the highest possible quality, which obviously costs more in money, Ruskin would take as axiomatic. I've got to show you some pictures from my hometown. I live in Geneva, New York, small college town, upstate New York, small city, very small city. Here's brick, a building done in brick. right? A natural material, very lovely. Here's a close-up of that brick. And all the bricks are slightly different, you see? They're not the same. It's not cookie cutter. Each of the bricks has a different quality to it. I teach at a place called Hobart and William Smith Colleges, Liberal Arts College in Geneva, New York. And we have two very old buildings right at the front of the main street. The one is called Geneva Hall, one is called Trinity Hall, and they are built of stone. And there's the stone. Now, the point to see, the Ruskinian point to see, is that all of these stones, which are making the building stand up, are all different from one another. And they're all, each of them has a kind of vibrancy and a character to itself. And if you see them from afar, which you do in Trinity Hall, they have a certain unity. But when you see them up close, they have a different level of vibrancy and lifeness, lifefulness in them. Build naturally, says Ruskin. Here's another lovely house on my street, a brick house. It's called the Prouty Chu Historical Museum. Yeah, look how beautifully it fits in with a natural environment. Everything in the image is natural. We like this. Here's the Maybeck, First Church of Christ Scientist, here in Berkeley, all built with wood. Yes? Most of you know it. Here's Tim, thinking about the joints, obviously, and how they were joined. Well, here's how they were joined. That's the roof. So again, this is natural material. You look up and each corner that you look at, the wood is different, the shapes are different, the carvings are different, the positionings are different. Nothing is the same. Here's a Sigma Phi fraternity on the University of Berkeley campus that Tim took me to last year when we were here. Built in wood, surrounded by a brick entryway and so on. Here is, in Santa Cruz, just a few days ago, a beach house built with wood. It has this character. Okay, so here we are on the West Coast. Now we go back to the East Coast. Here's a house made of wood on South Main Street in Geneva, New York. Here's another one. And those folks decided to do a lovely, lovely little wood-carved design up on the roof, near the roof itself. It's quite delightful. Now we come back to the West Coast, Santa Cruz. Here's one of the great Victorians of Santa Cruz. There's a whole number of them there. These buildings all have this force in them because they're built with real and natural materials. They are true to the things that are available to our hands, as Tim said. Here's wood inside a house. The grain on the floor, like in front of us here. Now imagine this floor in front of us as linoleum. And something happens to your old feeling of what it's all about. That's wood on a floor. Here's wood on another floor. Same house, different room. Here's a wood cabinet, built probably in the early part of the 1910, something like that. Here's wood interacting with natural stone on the floor. And it all has this feeling to it, truth. Yeah. Now, let's go shopping. This is our shopping mall. It's called Town and Country Plaza. It's just down the street from where I live, and I want you to remember Abbeville. They used to go shopping somewhere else. We go to Town and Country Plaza. This is our main grocery store. It's called Tops. It's not, but it is called Tops. Anyway, look at the wall here. Yes? Let's do something with the wall. No, sir, we don't do anything with the wall. It'll cost money, and nobody will look at it, and nobody will care anyway. So we won't do anything with the wall. Let's go to our office supply store. Let's go to Staples. Well, Staples looks like this, and next door to it is a small department store called Peebles, which I guess is a play on the word Peebles, but spelling is a problem in the modern world, as we'll see. Here's another part of the same plaza, Sally's. It's a beauty salon. And here's a tanning salon right next to it. And next door, a very different motif, as you can see. Let's go back. Here's the first motif. Here's the second motif. There's a lot of time and thought going into this, folks. We have the Village Store, a Hallmark card store, and we have Liquors. We don't even know whose Liquors they are, but they are indeed there. And here, for contrast, we have Abbeville. Yes? But that's only the plaza, probably unfair. Let's go to the pharmacy and get some prescription drug that we need, or aspirin or whatever we get there. You see how different this is from the plaza? Exceedingly different. The architects thought long and hard about how to make Walgreens unique. Yes? Well, let's go across the street, right across the street to Rite Aid. You see the spelling problem, of course. You go across the Rite Aid, and again, you have all of, this is not even brick itself. This is some kind of facade. I'm not quite sure what it is. I've looked at it a couple of times. But all of this is synthetic. It's concrete without any feeling tone to it. It's plastic. It's veneer. It's something. None of it is real. Good. Let's go have a cup of coffee. If you come from the East Coast, you've heard about Dunkin' Donuts. Well, I actually like Dunkin' Donuts coffee pretty well. Let's go there. Now, here's a natural building. There's nothing about this that's natural. It's all some kind of synthetic. And you go to any Dunkin' Donuts anywhere, and you can order the same sandwiches anywhere that you go. Now, I want you to get a sense of this from the point of this whole notion of truth. We're being told untruths. We're being told that this is not... we're being told that it doesn't matter. You're just going in there for a coffee. But that's not why you go in for a coffee in the Abbeville of old. And lots of places here in Berkeley, you actually go in and sit down and chat with people and have a cup of coffee in a nice place, and they've taken the time to put up some paintings and so on. But that's not the norm in America. This is the norm in America. You know, our disjoined civilization, to take Tim's metaphor again. Yes? Well, you need to lean on a counter in Dunkin' Donuts. There it is. All veneer. The floor is fake. That's not real stone. That's some kind of linoleum or some kind of plastic or something. And you need to sit down in a chair. Ah, there's a chair for you. Or if you don't like that one, you can take the one next to it, because it's very different than the one that you're sitting in right now. Yes? Or you want to go back to the plaza to go to the movies. You can see Rush, The Family, Baggage Claim, Prisoners, Meatballs 2, Battle of the Year, Don John, and Insidious, which I particularly liked in this context. You want to go buy things to build your home, you go to Value. They don't know how to spell either. Yeah? But the point is that we are hurt by this. Yeah? And what happens is that because this has become so pervasive, I can't resist this because I like that wall so much. This is the wall of Topps Market. And just for contrast, that's the wall in St. Wulfrun's. Yeah. So it's become so pervasive we forget that what we once had. We get older and we forget, and we think this is what shopping is all about. Yeah. So there's a wonderful book that I recommend to all of you by Peter Hazlitt. It's about the time before the Industrial Revolution in England primarily. It's called The World We Have Lost. And losing the truth of materials is like that. We've lost something that once gave us life, that was wonderful, exciting, and now it's gone. Yeah? So, St. Wulfrun's, but it doesn't have to be a church. Another wonderful Victorian in Santa Cruz. And it's a particularly lovely picture because next to it is a modern apartment building. You see the difference in living quarters. What does the one do to your consciousness as you live in the one? What does the other do to your consciousness as you live in it? Yeah. The lamp of power. The proof of a thing's being right, Ruskin wrote, is that it has power over the heart, that it excites us, wins us, or helps us. All great architecture has this ability to move, please, or delight us, to make us feel more alive, to make us feel thankful that we've had the chance to see it or use it, makes us, in the best cases, proud to be a member of the species that created it. And so there's a wonderful film. I highly recommend it to you if you've not seen it. Ken Burns is, of course, a great documentary maker of film in America. He has done many great, wonderful, complex series. His first film was called The Brooklyn Bridge. He did it as a graduate student while he was in New York. And it's about the building of the Brooklyn Bridge. And that's an incredible story all by itself. Many people think the Brooklyn Bridge is the most beautiful bridge in the world. One of them is speaking to you right now. And at the end of the film, When the bridge is finally opened, what Burns does is that he goes around and asks people, very famous people like Arthur Miller, Death of a Salesman, Paul Goldberger, the architecture critic for the New York Times, Lewis Mumford, the great urban historian. He says, well, what is it like for you to be on the bridge? And they say, or to see the bridge, they say they are always awestruck. And they look at it and they feel proud to have been in the presence of it, and they want to do something in there. It inspires them to do something in their own lives that they haven't yet done. Because they're in the presence of it, that's power. That's what Ruskin means by the power of a thing. Now, as well, though, he also wants us to understand that power is not just about size. Sometimes very powerful things are pretty small, but they still have that same quality. We look at it, we go, oh, my goodness. As, again, I'm just constantly thinking about Tim's talk and about the frames that he showed us that had all of this human effort in them. They're not huge. You look at them and you go, oh, isn't that wonderful? Yeah, that's power. That's exactly what Ruskin means by power. Compare in your mind's eye. I'll give you a little chance to do this later on. Your image of the Empire State Building, a commercial building, with the Houses of Parliament in London or the Lincoln Memorial. Different. Yeah. So a thing has power, Ruskin says, and this is sort of the end of his comment. He says, a thing has power when it in some way represents the essential experiences of human life, its joys, its successes, its struggles, its stumbles. And power is not reproducible. Two buildings exactly alike diminish the power of both, cheapen both. Imitation, in short, is not a good idea. Here's some pictures. The West Front, Rouen Cathedral. It's just overwhelming. I don't know how many of you have been. If you've not been, do go. It's a bit far, but you could probably get there before too long if you really wanted to. This is now this. Sacrifice, truth, and power. All together. And you look at it and you are awed and you said, wow, what could they have been? Wow, this is so, you know, we vote about our architecture with our feet. Or better said, our plane tickets. We go there to see what they did then. Very few of them come here to see what we're doing now. Yeah? Because these buildings, that time, has all of this life, this communal life force in it that we've lost because of all the separation of this modern world that we talked about. All right, here's just another view. Wherever you go, it's like being in a candy store of elegant sculpture. And if you read the sculptures deeply, you get the stories of all the saints. You get the stories of the town. I'll show you that a little bit later on. Here's another view. West Front, Rouen Cathedral, probably about noontime. West Front, Rouen Cathedral, sunset. Now imagine Town and Country Plaza at sunset and sunrise. And you see the point. The rose window, the great rose window in Rouen Cathedral with all the saints around it and all the stories, etc. Gorgeous. Sacrifice, truth, and power. Here's some more examples for you, just to show you it's not all about cathedrals. Grand Canal, Venice, the great palazzos. They didn't have to do all of this. Yes? It has a power over you. You walk, if you take the Vaporetto down, and when you first arrive on that, in the terrible train station, actually, architecturally speaking, terrible train station, and then you take the number one slowly down the Vaporetto number one slowly down the Grand Canal, you're just awed because of the power of these buildings have over you as you go along. More. And finally, you come into St. Mark's Square. And there's a wonderful passage from Ruskin that I hope to share with you a little bit later, if we still have enough time, about coming into St. Mark's Square for the first time. This is John Wharton Bunny's wonderful painting of St. Mark's in the 1870s or 1880s, Clive? 1870s, 1880s? Yeah. Anyway, commissioned by Ruskin, because Ruskin saw how beautiful, how incredible, how spectacular this building was as a living thing that has power over us, that excites us. And he wanted it preserved because they were always talking about restoration and doing certain kinds of things. He wasn't much of a fan of restoration. We could talk about that in Q&A if you like. But power, yes, but here's that bridge. Walking the Brooklyn Bridge, if you've never done it, I always tell everyone, I always take my students over the Brooklyn Bridge, whether they like it or not. The Brooklyn Bridge, you get the experience of, not from seeing it from afar, though that's wonderful, but by actually walking among these wires into this Gothic structure and through it and across to the other side. It's just enthralling. At every stage, the image, the shape, the size, the angles change, and you react differently as you go across. Yeah? The Brooklyn Bridge at night. Constant delight, huh? On a rainy day, as you can see. Yeah? And now, the North Porch, Rouen Cathedral. This is so, when the light is right, it makes you want to weep, because it is so beautiful. And you say, oh, they took the time to do this. They didn't have to do this. But look what they have done, and how exciting and wonderful it is. Power. Life. Buildings live when they express either in their whole or in their details the creative life force of all those who have built them. When the viewer or user can see or sense that these various creators delighted in their various workings. The vital question, Ruskin says, is only this: was the worker happy doing the work he or she did on this building? And when he says such a thing, note that he means all the workers who work on the building, from the overseeing architect to the lowliest stone cutters. He believed, again, this is implicit or talked about in Tim's talk, and I'm sure that Clive at least will bring us back to this in another way when he speaks to us later today. Ruskin believes that there's a creative spirit in every human being, however talented. Yeah, they may be manifestly talented like Giotto, or not very talented like a stonecutter, but there's something in them that makes them want to be part of the human community, part of the whole. And Ruskin said you have to give them the chance to have that experience. If you take that away from them, you kill them, you deaden them, you flatten them, you destroy their imagination. But you give them that chance, even though sometimes they'll have great successes in what they do and other times great failures in what they do. You give them the chance to be a human being. You give them a chance to find the thing that's in them, that spark, that's what's inside of them, and let it come out however it will. Yeah, now they have to work within a plan. I mean, it is, after all, let's say, a bridge. It is, after all, a church. It is, after all, a school. So they have to work within the plan, but you've got to give them the chance. And when you give them the chance, then all this wonderful humanity comes out. And they become part of us, and we become part of them, and we do it in this sort of varying things together. So you encourage, Ruskin always says, this chance for the worker of whatever level to grow. He was not a fan of the architect is God. That the architect has a vision, however creative, however wonderful, however beautiful, and then tells everybody exactly what to do. The whole community's involved. You got people who are making the wooden stalls inside the church. You got people who are doing the stone cutting on the outside. You got people doing the mosaics on the floor. You got people doing the windows and the stained glass. And you got people making the chairs. It's like a huge communal effort. That's why places like Abbeville and Rouen live. When you give people a chance to do this, when you give them a chance to let their life force out, it becomes another way for the buildings to come alive and to soar. So let's go back to that north porch. Early in the morning, light was not so great. When I was there with a group of other people, and we were looking at some things a la Mr. Ruskin. And I want you to look at this panel here, and this panel here, and then I'm going to give you a close-up of it. This is the panel that you saw on the right a moment ago, and in the panel, there are tiles, and there's, well, let's say, in each one, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 tiles, and I multiplied them all out on this side. On this side alone, this is just before the entryway, there's 90 such tiles. All the tiles are different, and on the other side, there's 90 more tiles, and all the tiles are different. They have different themes. Here's one, St. George killing the great dragon, the symbol of evil. Yes, and look at these little figures up here. They're not really necessary, but there they are. Somebody carved them. And here's one of our English Ruskin friends, Cynthia Gamble, who was with our group on that day. And she's pointing to a particular tile. And it took us a long time to find it because there's 180 of them. But we finally found it, and it looks like this. So it's again some sort of, it looks like, we weren't quite able to figure out whether it's a battle scene or it's whether they're attacking or whether this fellow is vanquishing this sort of creature here on the floor. But there's, I want you to look at this figure here. And I want you to look at this figure down here. And then there's another one up here. And now I want you to hear what Mr. Ruskin has to say about these. This is in his chapter on life in The Seven Lamps. We'll look first at this one. This is Ruskin's drawing of it, these two little figures outside the main frame. And he wants us to see that somebody was set free to do what they wanted to do with these figures. So here's how he describes what you're seeing on the screen. He says, when you come down to it, there's nothing particularly special about this particular tile's design or the carving of the wings and scales depicted. Something else, however, something special, emerges when you look closely. There are, in the features of thoughtfulness and fancy, something which is not common here, at least not common nowadays. The upper creature on the left is biting something, the form of which is hardly traceable in the defaced stone, but biting he is. And the reader cannot but recognize in the peculiarly reverted eye the expression which is never seen, as I think, but in the eye of a dog gnawing something in jest and preparing to run away with it. The meaning of the glance, so far as it can be marked by the mere incision of the chisel, will be felt by comparing it with the eye of the couchant figure, that's the lying down figure on the right, in its gloomy and angry brooding. The plan of this head and the nod of the cap over its brow are fine, but there is a little touch above the hand, especially well meant. The fellow is vexed, and he's puzzled in his malice, and his hand is pressed hard on his cheekbone, and the flesh of the cheek is wrinkled, and Ruskin underscores wrinkled, under the eye by the pressure. The whole, indeed, looks wretchedly coarse when it is seen on a scale of which it is naturally compared with the delicate figure etchings in other places, but considering this as a mere filling of an interstice on the outside of a cathedral gate and as one of more than almost 200 different such carvings, it proves the very noble vitality of the art of the time. I believe the right question to ask, and here we have a reprise of that, respecting all ornament, is simply this. Was it done with enjoyment by the person making the ornament? Was it done with enjoyment? Was the worker happy? It may be the hardest work possible, and harder to do because so much pleasure was taken in the doing of it, but it must have been happy, or it will not be living. There's a couple of PhD theses on this wall, if you took the time to do them. You look at one after another. They didn't have to do it, right? So now we have five lamps, right? We have sacrifice. We have truth. We have power. We now, or four, if I'm on number four, whatever one I'm on, we also have life. And there's this, who is this man? We don't know who this man was. But here we are, 700 years later, and he still delights us. Because he took the time to do it. Now, if you look here, we don't know this, but you can imagine this fellow, after having done this tile and probably a few others in the same panel, taking his grandchildren there and saying, you see, I did this. You see, I did this. You see, I did this. I'm very proud of this, you know. I wasn't the master architect, but I did this. And I feel really wonderful about the doing of it. You know, I'll tell you a secret, he'll say to his daughter. He'll say, this was really my brother Frederick. And he was always cranky. So I put him there. Yeah? And this was our dog. And he was always doing that, but I had to draw a little dragon, so I put our dog there. And that's what gives it life. That's what makes it come alive. Here's Ruskin's drawing of different arches, cathedral arches across Europe. Was the worker happy when they did this? Probably are happier when they did that, and happiest of all when they did that. The skill, the difficulty, the complexity, the challenge, huh? Mr. Giotto, from Tim's talk again. This is just one of the arches in the Campanile of Giotto in Florence. This is Ruskin's drawing of it. It's like gossamer wings. It somehow lifts up and is about, it looks like it's, this is all stone. It looks like it's about to fly away. But look at the excitement, the human life force that's imbued in it. So I want to say something about Gothic. We often say that Ruskin was a great fan of Gothic. In a way, that's true. But for Ruskin, Gothic was not a style. It was life. It was the life force expressing itself in different people. If there's anything that Ruskin can be brought back down to, is this notion of the importance of the life force in everybody. Here's a couple of sort of personal examples. In 1994, I had my first time in Venice, and my daughter Lauren was with us, and we had the great fortune to stay for a week or two in a pensione called La Calcina, that means the kitchen, on the edge of the Giudecca Canal. And Lauren, my daughter, went out and painted a lovely drawing. That's life. That's what she could do at 8 years of age, right? She said, March 7, 1994, by Lauren, I love Dad, the Calcina, John Ruskin, lived and worked in this house. That's what Gothic is. Yeah? My son, Jamie, was once an aspiring artist, no longer, as you can see. Well, you can't see, but anyway. But here he is. He did a drawing of his dad because he knew his dad was interested in Ruskin, and this could be done now, although the belly would be a little bit larger. And this is his dad giving a lecture about Mr. Ruskin. And the words say, I know you can't read them, they go, blah, 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 Ruskin. Blah, 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 Ruskin. Blah, blah. So some of you are probably feeling that way right now, so we'll pass over that. Back to the idea that before the churches were Gothic, the houses were Gothic. The churches lived because the people lived. This is Thomas Rook's drawing of a French courtyard. Gothic is life. Tim Holton has a phrase for it. We were talking about it a couple times as we were driving around the last 2 days. The vernacular, the living force of all of us. Yeah, not just the great among us. Not just the medium grade among us, all of us. And if you do that, it turns into this Turkish merchant's house in Venice. Not one of the greatest houses in Venice, but it has its own wonderful qualities to it. And if you're laying stone tiles, it turns into this on the floor of St. Mark's in Venice. Or it turns into this on the floor of St. Mark's. I mean, is this not beautiful stuff? Is this not exciting and wonderful? Yeah. Or it turns into this. And these are all on the floor of St. Mark's, and there's thousands of them. And none of them are the same. Huh? So in 1854, Ruskin gave his first series of public lectures in Edinburgh. And he had with him John Everett Millais, who was doing some drawings for him and painting the famous portrait of Ruskin at Glenfinlas. There's a whole story to be told there, but that's not our story today. And in any event, he gave his first series of lectures in Edinburgh, and he wanted his audience to understand what he meant between something that lives and something that doesn't live. And he had Millais do this drawing for him. And here's the drawing. This is the face of 100... quote-unquote lions, we're not quite sure what they are, that were on a particular building, surrounding a particular building in the Royal Mile in Edinburgh. They're supposed to be a kind of lion or tiger. Then he had Millais draw the head of a real lion or a tiger. This is terrifying, this one, but it's alive. And you get the life force out of it immediately. And this kills you. And your imagination, you go, oh my God, that's so ugly. And this is not friendly, but it's alive. Many of the designs that Ruskin deals with are floral designs. He wants us to be in tune with nature. He believes that human beings are part of nature. He wants us to be integrated with nature. So what better way to keep that remembrance going in our minds as to then have nature about us in the buildings that we create, have images of that nature. Yeah, so you've seen numbers of these before, but look at how lovely the carving of these plants are here above the Corinthian columns in a niche at Amiens. And the difference is here illustrated, another drawing from the lectures on art and architecture. Here's Greek, his framing of the Greek understanding of architecture. But here's the way the plant really is. And here, some leaves in fall in my town. And some more alive. So I want to read you one more passage. About leaves. He says, take a moment to do something that we hardly ever do. Take a moment to look at a branch of a tree in nature. Gather one from any of the trees or flowers to which the earth owes its principal beauty. And you will find that every one of the leaves, though sharing a similar shape and function, is different from the other, and that all have their individuality, and in that too is their wonder as living things. They are all the same, but they are all different, not unlike ourselves. And you will find further that if you examine nature carefully, this great difference amidst similarity is everywhere reproduced. You know how fond modern architects are of their equalities, how necessarily they think that each part of a building should be like every other part. But if you look, you shall find that nature abhors equality and similitude, just as much as unreflective men love them. You will find further, if you look at the stages of growth of any living thing, that nature takes incredible care to always keep itself out of equalities, and that all its grace and power in pleasing us are owing to its doing just this. Out in front of my house is a cherry tree coming out to blossom just a few weeks ago. Look at how wonderfully different and so vibrant and alive those are. Yes, and here's just another branch, a series of branches going on. Now, the Cathedral of Saint-Lô, also in France, near Cannes. This is Ruskin's drawing of it in the 1840s. Look what he's done with it. See the floral displays here. See how it interacts with the plant that's growing there. He just delighted in this sort of thing, the interaction of nature and the life force, and put the life force in the building, and it picks up the life force of the living things around it. Here's another set of Ruskin's drawings from the Seven Lamps, and here we have different floral designs in different buildings across Europe that were taking the time and the skill, the incredible skill that was needed to do these things. Yes, and here, some kind of plant coming almost into flower with this little bit of wonderful design in the middle, and here, a column carved differently, and here, the plant on which the column's motifs are based. They studied the plant. Then they figured out how to carve it, and then they put it in their building, and so the people who would go into the building would have the experience, the real experience of the plant itself. Here's the famous Lily Capital on St. Mark's, the Basilica of St. Mark's in Venice, which Ruskin loved much. Here are some floral designs drawn by William Gershom Collingwood when he was on tour with Ruskin in the early 1880s. Look how beautiful those are. Those are real leaves, folks, just done in stone. And here are the real leaves themselves. And here they are there. And here they are there. And here they are there. Life. All different. All the same. Here's the difference. Here. And here, a little entryway. Yes? Oh, this was so exciting. I saw this in Santa Cruz just the other day. We were driving around, my wife and I, and I said, oh my God, look at that. And the bougainvillea intended to crawl over the entryway. Look at the shadows that are created. All of this is thought through in some way. Yeah? And it delights us. Life. Beauty. For a building or some aspect of it to be beautiful, it must reference or image something lovely in nature. Its curves, its forms, its colors, its growings, its groupings, its special positionings. The best qualities of the human face or figure as well. We ourselves identify with nature, being part of nature, and we react positively and automatically when we recognize the natural, which is ourselves, in a building. A building or some essential aspect of it will be even more beautiful if it represents an image as closely as perfect to its own perfect form in nature. Let me give you a couple of examples. talked about this before. Here's Mr. Lincoln sitting. Don't think the building itself, the building is really wonderfully monumental and, you know, Greek Revival sort of building. But inside is Lincoln. And Lincoln is beautiful because you have the whole humanity of the man in the wonderful sculpture that's been done of him and placed inside the building. You have his thoughtfulness. You have his wisdom. You have his care. You have his tragedy. All of them are in that face. Yes? A kind of beauty. Here's another terrible beauty. The Michelangelo's Pietà St. Peter's in Rome. Beautiful marble, perfectly done, perfectly carved by a perfectly masterful craftsman, what shows us the great human sorrow of the death of a person close to us. No more the death of a child to a parent. No more the death of a Messiah to a religion. All of these rolled into it. Read it whichever way you wish. The great human tragedy of losing someone close to you. Look at her face. I mean, this is so transfixing and transcending. And there's great pathos in this and great beauty. St. Mark's Piazza. Great beauty. We're going through the lamps one after the other. Look how wonderful it looks. And then Ruskin has how am I doing for times here? Coming along? I'll try to finish it. So I won't read you the Ruskin passage. He has a passage that is so glorious about the entry for the first time into St. Mark's Square and seeing the Basilica and then looking carefully at all the figures dancing and flying and looking at each other and crisscrossing each other. And there's the St. Mark's lion with St. Mark's at the top on the building itself. And here's another image of it as well. But even down below in the arches, we have these different kinds of carvings. It's a cornucopia, almost never ending. I mean, it has major chapters on St. Mark's in the Stones of Venice, which Clive will be talking about later today. Here's the arch. This actually is a reproduction, but here's a fresco over the arch. Here's a detail. Yes? Here's another detail. They all took the time to do this. So again, the argument is that all of the beauty of the thing comes from the doing of all of these. Here's the pediment itself. He says in his passage, which I'm not going to share, but he talks about all the angels in adoration with a Venetian lion on the field of gold stars and blue, innumerable countless carvings, all expressing the joy of belief in this set of beliefs. But not just that. Around the corner, if you're in Florence, you'll find Della Robbia, wonderful bas-relief plaster castings that are above doorways. So beautiful. Yes? And here's a frame for you, Tim. I don't know whether you particularly like it. This is Henry Roderick Nguyen's painting of the front door of the Baptistery in Florence. But Ruskin's point is that in those times, everything was beautiful and intended to be beautiful. And all we thought of beauty as a thing that we really wish to have. Here's another painting of Ruskin's of one of the porch doors in Abbeville. But here, to take it smaller, is a piece of Ruskin lace. Everything can be made beautiful. And here's the Grand Canal at sunset. And Santa Maria della Salute at sunset. But it's not all in Europe. We're back to Mr. Maybach's First Church of Christ Scientist, right down the street from us. One. Two, the integration with nature. Three, the close-up of nature. Look how wonderful this is. Beautiful. So beauty lifts us. Memory. It is the responsibility of architecture to link us visually, emotionally, and intellectually to what has been the best of our past, to represent in some form the greatest deeds, ideas, or ideals which have characterized our society or our civilization, to remind us, to literally put back into the mind each and every day as we see or use a building of what it means to be a human being, to inspire us to emulate or improve on that which now exists so that in the future our children and our children's children will make things even better for their children and their children's children. See, he has one passage in the Seven Lampsary where he imagines the children going around and saying, see, this is what they did for us. We will do better for ours. This inspiration. So all great architecture is, in its very deepest sense, memorializing helps us remember our deep past, whether it's a government building or a religious building, room by room. Here's St. George on a wall in Venice. Not a particularly important wall, not a particularly great sculpture, but someone wanted to remember the lesson of St. George. Going back now, an ocean away, on the plaque of Geneva Hall at Hobart and William Smith Colleges, the class of 1920 bought a nice little slate piece of work, and they put it into the stone on the wall itself. And the class of 1921 decided to do them one better, because they put a Greek phrase on the top, which means to explore the unknown is good. Memories. Downtown Geneva, a cast iron building from the 1800s. This is the Smith Opera House. Memories. This is an opera house. This is a playhouse. So the front door, wonderful bas-relief here. Of various folks. And of course, the person on the right you know very well, Mr. Shakespeare. We have to remember Mr. Shakespeare. And the person on the left we should remember as well, because he was great as well. His name was Edwin Booth. His brother became more famous. But he, Edwin, was the greatest Shakespearean actor of his time. And so he belongs there. Yes, up on the hill at Hobart Wayne Smith, where I teach. Here's the founder. This is William Smith, the founder. A recent sculpture. William Smith College for Women was founded in 1908 by a rich nurseryman who made his fortune in doing nursery work. And he was talked into starting a women's college, since it was already a men's college at the campus, to have a women's college. So he did. And he was encouraged by Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Lucretia Mott. They all said, you got to do this for women. So he builds a campus. This was installed 100 years afterwards. He's going uphill, because going uphill in women's education was a serious thing in those days. There's a very lovely carving of his head done by one of our local people. This, now we're back across the water. We're in Siena, the town of Siena. Here's an image you saw a little bit earlier. This is in the Palazzo Pubblico. This is the Room of the Nine. It's called the Sala de Nove in the Palazzo Pubblico. And it's called the Room of the Nine because the nine judges of the city of Siena used to sit there and adjudicate claims that came before them. And when they walked into that room every day, and whenever who was being accused or defending, whatever, walked into the room, they would be reminded every day of what justice was, that justice had to be done. This figure is of wisdom. I have a better picture of her over here. Yes? Sapientia, wisdom, being inspired by the great book. She's distributing justice to those who need to be punished, yes. To those who need to be rewarded, yes. And then there's a cord coming out of here, which you can't say. Here's Tim's plane that he was talking about that goes through all of them to this figure on the right, which is on the front of Clive's book here, the figure of the common good, surrounded by temperance, courage, wisdom. Which one am I leaving out? Fortitude, thank you, right? And over here, a figure of peace. So when you walk into the room, these are immense, immense frescoes. They're done in the 1200s, the early 1200s, by Ambrogio Lorenzetti. And you're reminded every time, this is what you're here for, memory. Yes? And if you follow these principles, all good things will happen. So another great mural on the side is called The Effects of Good Government. And you see the city is well built and people are dancing in the streets, and outside the fields are full of wonderful fruits and it's safe to go outside. That's a memory to remember that that's what you're there to do justice. And then if you forget to do these things, there's another allegory on the other side, which is called the allegory or the effects of bad government. If you lie, you cheat, you steal. All the things that we will just imagine, the Ten Commandments, this is what happens. Justice is fettered. The devil rules. Not the great virtues reign, but all the vices reign. Gluttony and greed. All reminders. Why not do this? Obedience. This last one is kind of lovely in its way, because it's not quite what we expect. If we wish to live at the highest level of which we are capable, no one is free, now or ever. There are laws of nature which we must follow. if we wish to be well. At the most obvious level are the laws of nutrition and exercise. We can choose to eat foods which do bad things to our bodies, choose to watch television all day, never walk or run, and drink a great deal of whiskey. But if we choose, he didn't say that, but that's okay, you get the idea. But if we choose to eat foods which we know are better for our bodies and do things which keep the bodies in trim, we not only will be healthier, we're likely to live longer, and in that healthy state, be happier. Laws of healthy living exist. We may flaunt them. We may wish they weren't there. But if we ignore them, we will always pay the price. So the point here about architecture is that you must be obedient to all the lamps. All the lamps are the things that you must work to integrate into the buildings that you have. The workers who install those things will be happy in their work. They will grow. They will become more competent. They will become more alive. The community will be prouder of them. They will be prouder of their work. You don't have to do this. But if you don't, you pay the price. So by obedience, Ruskin doesn't mean something slavish. In fact, the opposite of that. He means, remember all the lamps when you build. You don't build for just you. You build for all the generations ahead of you. You build for all time. There's a wonderful passage where he says, God has lent us the earth for our lives. It is a great entail. God wants us, whether you believe this or not, or however you think of deity, but the principle is the same. We are enjoined to do the things that matter for human life at all times. We don't have to do it, but if we don't, we will all pay the price in another way. Quickly, remember, Shopping Plaza, Abbeville. Shopping Plaza, Capitola, just down south of here. Here's an exciting one. I just want you to see it happens on both coasts now. It's not just going on in Geneva, New York. Here's our Sears in Capitola. Here's the inside of the mall. And here's the inside of Dunkin' Donuts. Well, actually, it's not Dunkin' Donuts. It's Carl's Jr., but it is Dunkin' Donuts, which is also Carl's Jr. And you see they can't spell on the West Coast either. A little bit more grandiose now. Here is a picture of the San Giorgio Maggiore, the great Palladio church across from St. Mark's. Yeah? Not all the lamps are lit. It's a great building, tremendous power. Beautiful in its way. Yeah? Lots of sacrifice, cost a lot of money to get this done, but look at the paucity, if you will, of that. And compare it to this. Ruskin was no fan of the Renaissance, as we know. Greek revivals. This is my town. This is Sigma Alpha fraternity. Kappa Alpha. They had a new idea. They were going to design a building just like the other one. Here's the president's house. At my colleges, he had a new idea. Greek revivals. What are you reviving, Ruskin would say. The Greeks were Greeks, we're not Greeks. So why do we imitate the Greeks? Why don't we find our own way of doing these things? How are somehow the Greeks smarter than us, or better human beings than us, or more creative human beings? How come we can't find our own way to do this? Down the street, Trinity Church. Yeah, Gothic style. It's a church. So they said, well, it should be Gothic, right? So they build it into, and they have these lovely Gothic windows. Here's an entryway. Remember Abbeville. Yes? And I can't say that I'm unhappy to have this in town, but I want you to look at this and how formulaic it is and how wonderful that is. Obedience. They forget. Yes? Here's the main street in Munich, Ruskin drawing. Here's the main street, or part of it, in Santa Cruz. Pure pleasure. Yeah? Would you want to go to that dentist? The seven lamps of architecture. I'm just going to run very quickly. You can see them disappear. Here's on my own campus. This is called Elizabeth Blackwell House. And it was built in 1860. Very nice Victorian. Lovely, lovely dormers, slate roof. These chimneys are different from one another. Lovely wooden porch. Nice, different thing. All of this outgrowth, outgrowth. This building out of this alcove here. All nicely done. Another different thing here. And now they needed another dorm for women. And this one was built in 1909. It's called Miller House. And look what's gone. It's a pretty vibrant building. Now it's flat. The porch is sort of perfunctory. They have three dormers. The dormers are done in sort of Tudor style because it seemed like a good idea. Yes? Now we have 1932, another building called Comstock House, done in sort of a Federalist style, neo-Federalist style. Look what's gone. There's almost nothing here. Now look at this brick wall. Nothing's going on. We are dulled by this. We choose not to. And then the piece de resistance, the last building on the hill, Hirschhorn House. Mr. Hirschhorn must be very proud of having such a building named after him. This is 1962, and it's all gone. All the lamps are gone. So in 100 years, you can watch the lamps disappear. Ruskin says, people will lie to you in all sorts of ways. They can never lie to you in their art and in their architecture. They put their souls into their art and their architecture. You can read what's going on, and we are one by one putting them out. Here we're back to Santa Cruz for a moment. Just want to show you this one because it's a lovely, lovely example. So here are some designs that go around the front of a hotel. Comes around the side. They figure it's a back street. Nobody's going to look at them. So they don't want to spend the money to put the extra designs up there. We lose. They're not particularly great designs anyway, but we lose anyway. I mean, that's better than that. Grandiose. Huge. Powerful. BCE place, like the nave of a great cathedral, but not, in Toronto. Truly immense and awe-inspiring power. But nothing much else is going on. This is a tribute to finance, to Canadian finance. Well, then, now we have Mr. Wright. Beautiful building, really, really impressive. But Frank always said, that chair goes there. We don't move the chair. That's what we're doing, because I'm the architect. So where's life? And where's all the other things that would involve us in the community? Here is one that many people like. This is the Geary Disney Concert Hall in L.A. Yeah, powerful, immense. But where are all the lamps? A couple of them are there. You know, these are monuments to modernism and postmodernism. Here's Daniel Libeskind's Royal Ontario Museum, attaching to the old part of the building, as you can see here, in Toronto. I know people, I've been inside, and it's very weird to walk around with these windows and see the art and the displays that they're doing, but it is an impressive building, but no. So I want to give you as my last example. I want to give you all the lamps lit in one place. This is also in my town, and I choose this specifically because it's a small town. It's not a very important town in the history of America. We have small colleges, and we've got a Cornell Experiment Station and a few churches, and this is the United Methodist Church. And 100 years ago, this is now 2014, 100 years ago, in 1914, they decided that they were going to have stained glass windows to beat the band. They were going to have the best stained glass windows in all of Geneva to rival any that were in upstate New York. So they hired the Pike Company, and the Pike Company is a descendant, well, Pike himself studied with Tiffany, and they designed this window, and here are all the lamps at once. Sacrifice, truth, beauty, life, obedience at the end. I've left one out, power. And you walk into the sanctuary, which is a big, wide-open sanctuary. It's one of these sort of it's sort of Greek amphitheater style. And the windows are so huge, they overpower you, and they take your breath away. And this one is story of Jesus, the Good Shepherd. Story of Jesus, suffer the little children to come unto me. And so they painted this, and they said, this is an important verse from the Bible. We want to be reminded of this. So the preacher is, let's say, where I am, and audience is where you are, and the two windows, immense, are on either side, and you can always look at them, and they're always shining at you during the service. It's really astonishing. Yeah? So there's a close-up of one. Another panel. Were the workers happy when they did this? Here's the memorial to the people who gave the most money at the bottom of the window itself. Look at the colors, folks. Isn't this spectacular? Yes? And here's the other window. This is the Good Shepherd, another great story from the Bible where Jesus goes out to save the one sheep that was lost. And he sets up sheep's as important as anybody else. Sounds like Ruskin on the Lamp of Life. Here's a close-up of that. These are real sheep. Yeah? It's a real fellow bringing this home. Look at the detail. Look at the tree. Look at the surroundings. Look at all the work that's in this. Beautiful. The workers are doing all of this. Down below, another one. Here's a relatively unimportant panel. Another view. Look at the sky. Just enthralling. I always take guests there to see it. And again, the memorial of it. So, seven lamps of architecture. All of them. Most of them we have forgotten. We remember one, we remember two, maybe we remember three. We're not even sure what exactly they are. When they're all there, we thrive. When they aren't, we die. And we don't even know we're dying. The great tragedy of it is that we don't even know that we're dying. So what Ruskin wants us to get a sense of is to remind ourselves that we are all builders. How do you begin? Well, Tim asked this question. Well, you begin with your own house and your own rooms. Ruskin always said you put in your rooms the things that mean the most to you, that you love the most, that give you most inspiration, that give you joy when you walk into the room, because that's what a picture of me when I was 20 years old, and I particularly like that picture because, and there's my mother and there's my father, but over here's a painting that I bought once, and my God, I love that painting, and I love to be surrounded by that painting, and your books and your bookshelves, they're all there for you. Yes, and you surround yourself with all the beautiful things, and then you build. And then all the people who come into your house will see all the things that you love and will learn about you from the things that you have put around you. And they will learn the lessons of your life and reflect on them in their life. But leave the walls bare. Keep the floor covered with something like linoleum. Take away the wood furniture and put in something metallic. And we're dead. So seven lamps of architecture. We do not have to follow them. We should. If we do, we live. If we don't, we die daily. I think Margaret Mead said this, little deaths. Who wouldn't follow them? Thank you for your time.